Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon. It's time for an hour of food and drink with me, Matt Bentman.
And me, Alan Alder.
Our thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. And today we hear about La Latina Bus Durante, a double-decker bus bringing Colombian and South American food to Cambridge. And it's about to set off. We have a return of our occasional On the Menu feature, where we go to the Green Man in Grantchester and discover a menu rich in foraged and local food.
We hear from Bill Sewell. He is the owner of the Michael House Cafe in Trinity Street, and he'll be talking about his new book. And I'll be talking about possible new foods with Dr. Sue Bailey. We've also got Matt donning a beekeeper's outfit and going too close for comfort to hives full of bees.
And of course, we've got our Cambridge food and drink news section at the end of the programme. Now, let's begin with a new food. Earlier in the week, Alan spoke with flavour contributor Dr. Sue Bailey about research into foods.
Sue, some of your students at London Metropolitan University are researching into food. Could you tell us about what two or three of them are doing at the moment?
Yes, well, these are students who are starting off on their research and a couple of students who are finishing. One of the students is looking at date-flavoured yoghurts, which is something that's not really on the market. And she's looking at the difference between using a date syrup and date puree and seeing which is most effective at different types of concentrations. So very shortly, we're going to be setting up some taste panels using our electronic taste panel system and some suitable victims at the university, which will be fun.
Is it likely to lead anywhere? I mean, if she discovers that there's a method of making date-flavoured yoghurt that people really, really like, would she be able to approach a food company? Would they be interested?
Oh, potentially, yes. I mean, some students have done this in the past, particularly if they've already been working within a food company. And so they've done some research for their master's course that have then led perhaps to some commercialisation of those products. For this particular student, she's a full-time student of an Indian background, so it's quite likely that perhaps when she returns home, she may have a go at commercialising it herself.
So there's still a lot of research going on into new flavours or new ways of creating tasty products, then. It's a big deal.
Oh, it's a very big deal. And all the food companies that are out there are very keen to do new product development on the whole. It can be quite expensive, but this is nice when you can get student research linking in with food companies, publishing the results of their research, and undertaking work that perhaps particularly smaller companies may not have the funds or the time to be able to do.
So there's quite a few people employed then in...
In terms of food product development, yes, it's quite an interesting area because you can either have a sort of chef background and go into it from a very creative angle, but it's interesting to combine that with a much more scientific understanding of flavour profiles and the reason why certain ingredients work well together.
You're more likely to get something that's tasty if you know some of the underlying theory, I suppose.
Yes, that's true. I mean, the food chemistry is a fascinating area, and knowing about ingredients, how they interact, how different types of substances work together is very, very helpful in terms of developing new products.
Right. So what other products are people working on?
Well, we've got quite a few students and some of them particularly working with me. One is working on a gluten-free breakfast drink shake and looking at different types of flavour profiles there and which is the most acceptable and the acceptable level of natural sweetness, not using any sweeteners to go into this, because a lot of those drinks are in fact incredibly sweet if they're a breakfast shake type product. And then I've got other students looking at unusual grains, for example looking at millet, looking at buckwheat, looking at organic profile of buckwheat production and seeing how well that can actually be undertaken in Eastern Europe as opposed to in the UK, because this particular student has got an Eastern European background. One of my other students is also looking at developing high-protein grain bars and particularly looking at the texture of those when you reduce the fat and sugar. That's quite a tricky area.
Because fat and sugar are important in creating the texture.
Yes, they are important in creating the texture, they're important in giving flavour. And you can obviously substitute certain other products there, and that's what he's looking at. But also in terms of texture, this is where you've got to look at certain other things such as gums in terms of making it a better textured bar.
Right, gums like...
Well, gums are a particular type of substance that are naturally extracted. Typically, they're, although they don't sound particularly natural, things like xanthan gum and guar gum are actually extracted from natural plants. Things such as carob gum is extracted from carob beans. Right. And that has a slightly sort of chocolatey flavour profile to it. Oh. So there's some interesting gums out there which we're going to be looking at in terms of which are the most acceptable for these products.
And the advantage would be health benefits, because the high protein bar would rely less on fat and less on sugar.
Exactly so, that's right, yes.
Yeah, all right, okay. And you're quite interested yourself, aren't you, in sort of less usual foods? Aren't you growing things or thinking of growing things?
I'm thinking of growing things, yes. I've got some seeds which I did acquire at CD Sunday, in fact, a little while back, and in Trumpington, which I will be having a go at growing as soon as the frost has gone, which is hopefully very shortly. And one of these is amaranth, which is a very interesting vegetable. Have you ever heard of it?
I've not heard of amaranth. No.
Well, what it is, it's this particular one has got very, very bright red, almost some bright red, some dark red leaves that you can treat and eat almost like spinach. It also has a type of grain that's a bit like a millet grain and grows about 5 foot high. So I'm going to have a go at seeing how well I can grow that. And then there's something else that I'm going to be trying, which I have only recently come across, which is this very strange nasturtium tuber.
Nasturtiums don't normally have tubers, do they?
Well, they don't normally have tubers unless they're Peruvian. And this is a genus of the nasturtium plant that they were originally, or still are, grown in Bolivia and Peru. And they have very sort of strange little tubers to them. They're white, they're orange, they're red, they look really, really pretty. And a friend of mine who is a chef showed these to me recently. I was absolutely fascinated by these small tubers that have a slightly, I gather, turnipy taste to them and are very good pickled. So I'm going to try and see if I can grow this tuber, because this is also quite rampant and looks a bit like a nasturtium, but grows probably up a beanpole. So I'll perhaps try growing them with my nice English beans.
Yes, right. Well, look, when you do grow these things, you must bring them in. And
I will indeed.
Feed us with them.
I would be delighted to. I just hope that I can grow them. But I'm sure with a nice little bit of tender, loving care, Cambridgeshire rain and a bit of sun, we should be getting there.
Well, let's hope you do. Thanks very much, Sue.
Thank you.
Yes, well, if Sue is successful in growing her nasturtium tubers, we will have her back in the studio with them and we will try them out. And I must say, I do find talk of new foods exciting.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And coming up, how I survived an onslaught of bees. There's also foraged food on the menu at a local pub. La Latina restaurant sets off in May. But first...
Bill Sewell runs the Michael House Cafe in the town centre. It's inside a church, which may sound unusual, but as a business plan, ecclesiastical restaurants and cafes have worked out very well for him. Bill opened vegetarian restaurant The Place Below in the crypt of a working church in Cheapside, London, in 1989 and won a Time Out Restaurant of the Year award.
Bill now lives in Hereford and since 2002 has been running a cafe there in All Saints Church. It's a great sight because the church is right in the middle of town, lots of people passing on all three sides every day. So you see, it's a good strategy. I met up with Bill recently to talk about his new cookbook, which begins its Kickstarter crowdfunding mission on Monday.
I really got into cooking for people when I was studying history at Trinity College here in Cambridge. The offer of food at Trinity was something called savoury rice, and then the next evening it would usually be savoury rice, and similar the evening after. And I loved food, and I wanted to eat nice food, so I started cooking for myself, and I had this book, which I think my mum had given me, called The Vegetarian Epicure, by a Californian woman called Anna Thomas.
The book, The Vegetarian Epicure, emphasised full-on deliciousness. Not so much health or showboating with style and presentation. Rather simple, full-on deliciousness. And it's that sentiment that lies at the root of Bill's cooking.
So that got me going and I started inviting friends around to eat. I loved the feeling that I would cook something for people and they'd come over all warm and glowy and smiley and thank you. And I'm a complete sucker for praise. I can still remember this 40 years later. I can still remember burning a potato gratin in this professor's room. But I was doing it because I wanted to give pleasure to people. I've become a vegetarian through working on a chicken farm on a kibbutz in Israel. It's an experience that stayed with me really, particularly because the people who were permanently working in the chicken shed were clearly affected by having to treat these animals in a pretty unpleasant way. You know, you can't do it nicely. It was a big, commercial, intensive chicken-rearing shed, massive, great place. The people running the kibbutz didn't really have much time for namby-pamby English boys coming out there and being delicate about these things, so they explained to me very clearly my job was to grab 5 hens in each hand by their legs, stuff them in these boxes and whack the lids down before they could escape again, and then the truck came along to take them to the abattoir and processing place. And I found it pretty hard to take, and I think I got transferred to dishwashing and vine pruning shortly afterwards, but that was the moment at which I decided to become a vegetarian. And I stayed that way for about 10 years.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform. This is Westminster.
So I then learned as a vegetarian. My formative learning period was when I was a vegetarian.
Yeah.
And I cooked in a health food cafe in Westminster, which was actually a great place, although very scruffy, very kind of hairy armpits. And I learned to make bread, roll pastry, make great big vats of casserole for 100 people, and everything made from scratch every day. And that was a real kind of foundation stone for me, and that is what we do. I also got some experience working in a fancier place, at Launceston Place, which certainly has been a Michelin-starred restaurant. And that was another fantastic learning experience because the level of organisation, cleanliness, was a whole league above what I'd experienced in my hippie cafe in Westminster. And so I think I took those two things, the honesty and the simplicity of the vegetarian cafe and professionalism and attention to detail on flavour and quality of ingredients that somewhere like Launceston Place has. Mm-hmm. And those are two strands that have really kept with me.
And along with the third strand of just wanting to make people happy with his food represents the three main tenets of Bill's cooking career.
Here at Michael House Cafe, we know where the chickens come from, we know the farm they've come from, we know the Hereford farm where our sausages, ham and bacon comes from. Whenever we employ a new member of the management team here, they come over to Hereford to visit the farm so that they can see the pigs. And they are beautifully looked after by people who know animals, who love animals, who understand them. They still get killed in the end, I'm not running away from that. But it is a decent life and decent for the people looking after the animals as well. So I got back into meat cookery, and that's been also an interesting journey, and I think is a journey that's informed my new book, because I think people who've in their formative cooking years have been cooking with meat take a lot of things for granted. When I came back to meat cooking, you look at a lot of cookbooks, they're actually really annoying to use because recipes aren't all on one page and that kind of thing. So, yeah, the control is great. It's not really because I'm a control freak, because actually this has been very much a team operation. But it is about being free of the financial constraints of big corporations. Mm. And that makes me sound like some hippie, which clearly I am. But I'm a real believer that the whole sort of sensuousness of cooking starts with the shopping, possibly even the growing, if you're involved in growing, and continues right through to the washing up. Mm. Yeah, washing up. Am I really odd? I actually quite enjoy washing up at home. Some David Bowie on the music. What is eating about? Eating is about sharing food around a table, you know, and that's really what you're doing in a cafe. I just love those interactions with the food, with the ingredients, and with the people who are going to eat it.
Now, the reason we're here today is because you are about to publish a new book. Now, you published two books in the past, one in 1996 and one in 1999.
Food from the Place Below and Feasts from the Place Below.
Yes.
Yeah, and amazing. I mean, here we are, over 20 years on from the first one, nearly 20 years on from the second, and those books are still selling, and I feel amazingly proud of that. And I actually think they're good books. I have them on my shelf, and I keep looking at them, because I can't always remember the quantities for the chocolate brownies or whatever. But now, my cooking's just changed a lot in the last 20 years. And I think I'm now kind of looking, what's really worked? What have been the really fantastic things that we're doing now, that we did 10 years ago, that we did 20 years ago? What are the best things? And that's what's in this book. It's food that has lasted not just once. It's not just something that's got a bit of quinoa in, so it's fashionable this week. This is food that is delicious 10 years ago, it's delicious today, and I'm pretty confident it'll be delicious in 10, 20 years' time. It's great, solid, flavoursome stuff. Not only to eat, but wonderful to make. One of the big changes, of course, in my eating and cooking life is that I'm used to be a vegetarian. I'm now highly omnivorous. So we've got a fantastic load of slow-cooked meat recipes. Any of your listeners who come to Michael House will know that we now do a roast chicken and rice dish every day. This is the most fantastic selection of recipes, where the chicken's marinated, cooked on top of the rice, so the chicken juices all cook into the rice with the spicy marinade. Get this amazing sort of pilau style rice underneath spicy roast chicken. So we've got a few of those recipes. We've got a great steak and ale pie recipe. So there's an interesting example, steak and ale pie. You say, oh God, not another steak and ale pie. First of all, what sort of beef do you use? Shin, get shin. Look at the shin as you maybe get it diced by the butcher, because that saves a bit of time. But you'll see all that connective tissue running through it. Looks pretty unappetizing at that stage. Cook it for 3 or 4 hours, and that will have all melted down and gives you that lovely gelatinous mouthfeel. It's so beautiful. So you've got great meat. Make sure you get decent stout in there. We use both fresh mushrooms and dried porcini mushrooms. Then obviously you want great pastry. There's a fantastic cream cheese pastry recipe in this book. So there you have a thing which in one line is, oh yes, it's just another beef and ale pie. But you make it and your mouth and your head and your body will be transported to a good place. So that's what this book's about. It's not about the next pomegranate molasses. I'm giving perfect recipes which mostly take existing known things to a really good new place and which have been tested to death. I mean, one of the great things of where I'm coming from is I've cooked for thousands of hours in the cafes, but I'm also the home cook. I've got a foot in both camps, and I know that the way we cook in the cafes is a little bit different to how you cook for four or for six at home. Yeah. So the book is informed by that difference. Things are tested to death, both in the cafes, but also I've got a whole team of testers working on all the recipes to make sure that they work in different ovens or that I know what different ovens will do to them. So it's a book of utter deliciousness that's lovely to make, great to eat, none of it technically difficult. You've got to take trouble, you've got to mind about it. But then why would you be cooking it if you don't mind about it?
And one damn song that can make me break down and cry.
The other great thing, which is completely new to me in this book, is I'm publishing it via crowdfunding. It's being financed via crowdfunding on Kickstarter. Now, this is a date that all your listeners have to stick in their diary, 1st of May. Go to Kickstarter, put in Bill's Kitchen, and on the 1st of May, you can pre-order the book.
Yeah.
Now, this is a great model. For anybody out there who's thinking of writing a cookbook, I think it is a fantastic model because it means I've got to really connect with people in advance. I've had far more communication with people about this book, far more drafts sent out, far more feedback that I've received before I've even really started writing it, because it's going to be crowdfunded and I need to be in connection with people. I need to know, why should people buy this book? I need to be in a position to sell it right from the beginning. And it's meant that I can do it the way I want. So I don't want to skimp on this book. It's going to be hardback. It's going to be good quality paper. It's going to have those nice coloured cloth bookmarks in it. My previous books were published by HarperCollins. I am not somebody that can go up to Rupert Murdoch and say, you need to spend more on my cookbook, mate, because he wouldn't be very interested. But when I'm doing it myself, I can choose. It can be the best, and that's what I want it to be. I want this to be a book that people will be using in 20 years' time. So it's got to be robust. It's got to open well. It's got to have an index that works properly. So Marianne Ryan, who's the editor, she's done tons of really great editing with books where an index is important, because obviously non-fiction books like cookbooks, an index is crucial.
Now, the Kickstarter runs from the 1st of May to the 31st of May, yes?
Yeah.
What's the word?
The rewards is rewards. What they call them. So the way Kickstarter works is, and I didn't know this till about 2 months ago, I say I'm trying to raise £15,000 to pay for the printing of the book. It may pay for a bit of the photography costs as well. I won't get any of that money until we actually start selling the book. But to raise that money, I offer rewards. I'm called the creator on Kickstarter. So the creator offers rewards to people who want to back the project. Essentially, I'm offering advance ordering of copies of the book. But there's lots of other good stuff on it as well. So you could go onto the site and order one copy of the book to be delivered to your house as soon as the book's printed. You could go onto Kickstarter and say, well, actually, I'd really like to see behind the scenes at Michael House. So you could have a day's working with Lowndes in the kitchen, lunch for two, and two books to take home afterwards. And that costs a bit more. I can't remember. It's £100 or something. If you really want to push a boat out, invite 20 of your friends to dinner at my house in Hereford, and I'll cook dinner for 20 of you. But you'll have to pay quite a lot of money for that. Will you come? But no, so there's a whole variety of things. I think the least is £5. For you can get an e-book for £5. So it's a great vehicle for people both to do in a very kind of casual way, but also for people who really want to get involved and are really kind of fascinated by the whole thing. There's different levels. There's one where I'll come and spend a day talking with you about a cafe business project you might have. Yeah, there's all kinds of ways people can be involved, and I think that is another really nice thing. It's a vehicle for making links. I don't understand social media very well, but I get this little corner of it, connecting with people.
We're coming up to the final few moments of your book being finalised before it goes off to the editor, yes?
Yeah, so we've got four more photography sessions planned. Each time I have a photography session, I'm writing up the recipes, testing them, and then sending them all out to my team of testers. They're testing, they're giving me feedback. I'm reincorporating that feedback into the recipes. Then the pictures and my text go off to Michael, the designer. He fits them into the page setup. Marianne, the editor, starts looking, making sure that I haven't put beetroots in the ingredient, but not beetroots in the method.
Yes.
And so it's a very creative time because this is the absolute heart of producing it. So I'm loving it. I was actually awake at 3:30 this morning thinking about it. So I'll get up and start tapping away. For me, especially in the cafes, but in my home life as well, deliciousness, stuff that you want to eat and drink again and again and again and again and again is the number one thing. So I hope that Bill's Kitchen will be a book that people will feel comfortable, both if they've been cooking for a long time, but also if they need a bit of hand-holding. I hope they're recipes that people will be given confidence by, because I want people to use this book, not just stare at the lovely pictures. And I still feel 35 years on, 40 years on from then, I still feel I'm on a journey.
Yeah.
And that's one of the lovely things about the world of food, is you never get to the end. There is nobody who's got to the end. I mean, not Michelle Roux, not certainly not Jamie Oliver, you know, none of us. And I love that thing of learning.
Wonderful. Bill Sewell, thanks very much for this interview. Your book will be Bill's Kitchen. I suppose the expected release date is the 1st of October?
The release date's 1st of October, but the date I really would like you to have in mind is the 1st of May. Go on to Kickstarter, Bill's Kitchen.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And that was Bill Sewell. And the Kickstarter for Bill's cookbooks begins, as you know, on the 1st of May. And you can find out more of Bill's exploits on his food blog. It's called billsblog.co.uk, which he writes because customers often at his cafes are asking him for his recipes, and blogging helps to address that.
Right. When Sue Bailey came into the studio during the week to talk about new foods, she mentioned a chef who makes a lot of use of local and foraged foods, so some really interesting things. So I suggested that she go and talk with him, and she did. So here is Dr. Sue Bailey speaking with Steve Thompson, chef at the Green Man in Grantchester, about the pub and its food.
It's a lovely old building. It's like 400 years old, and we try and get that character across into our food. So we try and use a lot of knowledge from the local area and historic dishes and maybe recreate them, use a lot of produce from the surrounding areas, the meadows, the orchards around us, and use as many of the local farmers around us to produce the food that we do.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. I mean, to actually have that emphasis on local food, local farmers, local produce, that sounds to me something like no one else is really doing in the area.
Well, we try and do it not just for the sake of doing it. We try and do it to use the best produce that we can. So we're not just using something because it's local. We're using something because it's good. It just happens to be local. For our vegetables and stuff, we get a lot of it grown for us by our customers.
And what sort of things are you talking about?
Well, we have Jerusalem artichokes grown for us in Barton. We have squashes, summer and autumnal squashes grown for us. We use a company called Dynamic Organics in Barton that grow for us on the edge of Blairwash Manor. And he will also custom grow different varieties of radishes, heritage. We'll have all of our summer salad leaves grown for us. We'll have all our spring onions, different varieties of beetroot. The list is endless. Hopefully next year he's going to carry on into the winter as well, so that'll keep us going all year round.
So you're trying to focus as much as possible local produce, seasonal produce, and good quality and good flavoured produce.
Yeah, well, the real reason around trying to use local is it gives you that fresh, sweet vegetable flavour. It takes you back to being a child and eating straight from the garden.
Yeah.
You don't lose anything in the transit.
No, that's perfect. So frankly, in terms of footprint, what you're talking about is somebody bringing something on their bike, somebody bringing something very locally to you. And that's as near as you can get to local.
Yeah, it helps build up a community as well in the pub. So it means that people can take pride in what they've grown at home, bring it in and see what happens to it at the end.
Can you give me some examples of some of the dishes you have done recently using this type of produce?
We've got some lovely lambs in at the moment that we're getting in that at the moment are currently grazing on Childerly Estate in Dry Drayton. Mm-hmm. So we get them in from straight from the farmer. They're Jacob's flocks. They're Dorper lambs. Absolutely brilliant. It's originally a South African breed. It's a cross between Dorset Horn and the Black Herd Persian sheep, hence the Dorper name. It's bred as a meat sheep. I mean, we use that a lot. We use that with some... We get the whole animal in, so we butcher it ourselves. We use it head to tail, so we use the hearts, all the offal. I mean, we do lovely dishes with that, where we did a little suet pudding with the shoulders. We do a nice slow-cooked bit of the loin, so it's lovely and pink, but really delicately cooked. Keeping it very simple with some of the local onions we get grown on the fen.
And you've been using wild garlic and some other wild foods as well recently, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, we have. We like to go and pick as much as we can for our restaurant. Wild garlic we go and pick. We've got to keep the location secret.
But... Oh, of course.
No, so we do that. We make a lovely oil out of that. I mean, the main base we use that for is for mayonnaises. It's a lovely, we extract all the flavour and all the chlorophyll, so it's bright green.
I've Real seen it. It's strong amazing. Flavor. Yeah. It's beautiful. And what are the other things you mentioned Jack by the Hedge. What is Jack by the Hedge?
Jack by the Hedge is a garlic mustard leaf, is its other name, and it's a brassica, part of the mustard family, and it grows everywhere. It's like a weed. It'll be intertwined with all the nettles. It's not as garlicky as wild garlic, obviously, but it's got a lovely kind of middle. You get the mustard, you get the garlic.
I bet so many people walk past it and have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I mean, even simple things like dandelions that you walk past. We turn that into marmalade, we currently do. We get some smoked eels from Chapel and Swan Smokehouse over in Exning at the moment. And we do a little crumpet with that, with dandelion marmalade.
That sounds lovely.
A lovely little bit of Norfolk Mardler goat's cheese as well from Fielding Cottage. It's all trying to bring the east of England into one place and showcase what we have.
Yes, and I've tried some of the butter that you've had recently, and that's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, that's from Fen Farm Dairy over in Bungay, Suffolk. They do the Baron Bigod Brie-style cheese, which is just absolutely standout, and their butter's the same. It really, really holds its own with any other butter you'll have.
Yes.
And it's just a beautiful produce. I mean, we sell it. We also sell it over the bar to customers, just as whole packs.
Which is fantastic.
It's wonderful. I mean, I take it home with me as well. It's one of those produce that you just... Once you've had it, you can't go
back. You don't want to go back.
Door.
Exactly. So what do you see as the sort of future of food for the Green Man then?
Well, we just want to carry on, really, supporting the local area, supporting all of our clientele that come in and support us. It's like something nice to give back, but we want to keep the food simple, but also interesting and different. The amount of times we trial dishes to get it right, I mean... The first 100 times you get it so wrong.
100 times.
Wow. Yeah, you've got to really try it and work at it to get it right. And that's what we're trying to do there. And we're trying to start building that whole level of passion in the whole area. So not just into what we do in the food, into what we do with the beers, we've got a wonderful gin selection that we're doing at the moment and get the passion into that. And it makes your day-to-day working life a lot more
fulfilling. More pleasurable, exactly. Yeah. To actually have this locally, I think we are so very lucky to have someone like yourself actually championing the idea of local produce, local food, locally grown, and to get real flavours of Cambridge and Cambridgeshire and East Anglia. Nothing better. That sounds fantastic. Well, I think we need to go back to the restaurant now and perhaps you'll give me a sample. Now we're back into the warmth, Steve. And what have we got here?
We've got smoked eel crumpets with Norfolk Mardler goat's cheese and dandelion marmalade.
Norfolk Mardler goat's cheese. Tell me a bit more about that.
It's made by Fielding Cottage over in Norfolk. It's a lovely goaty. It's goaty and acidic, but without being overpowering. It works very nicely with the smoked eel.
Oh, that's fantastic. And what else did you say was that?
We've got dandelion marmalade. The petals give the bitterness to it, and the base is made with the old rosy cider.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm really looking forward to taste this. Thank you, Steve. I think... I will be coming back here again. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Sue Bailey speaking with Steve Thompson, chef at the Green Man. Do you ever eat there, Alan?
Yes, I do, actually. I ate there, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, and it was the end of their winter menu, their spring menu, which I think contains a lot of these forage things, hadn't started yet, so I'm going to have to go back. It's a really interesting menu, and, you know, it's worth seeking out.
And of course, that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on. So, for example, tonight at the Live and Let Live in Mawson Road, it's the second day of the Rum Festival with more than 130 rums. I don't think you should try them all. And also tonight at Food Park in Granter Place at the bottom of Mill Lane near the Doubletree Hotel, there's Kura Kura, the Sri Lankan and Southern Indian street food.
Now, last December, Flavor's Ruth Reyes covered the story of La Latina Bastorante. And more recently, they were on the Channel 4 programme Hidden Restaurants. And now, after a long wait, they are about to begin trading. Alan spoke with Catalina Uribe and got an update. But first, a reminder of what they're about.
La Latina Bastorante is a restaurant in a double-decker bus. So basically, we both are all double-decker bus and we convert it into a restaurant. So we set up a kitchen in the ground deck, and then upstairs we have tables and seats where we can sit approximately 45 people.
45 people, that's 45 a good number.
Yeah, it's a good number. I hope we're going to be very busy.
Well, I hope you are. And I know there's a private launch on Saturday night, but when are you going to be open for everybody to enjoy it?
Well, we aiming to open in the second week of May. So on Saturday, we're going to have this private event for our family and close friends and a few of the local foodies. And then we're going to open in the second week of May, hopefully.
Right, and where are you going to be in the second week of May? Is that sorted out yet?
Yeah, we haven't revealed our locations yet. Basically, what people have to do is basically they have to follow us on the social media to know where we're going to be on that day and what time we're going to open. Because at the beginning, we're going to have different locations, so we're going to move from one pitch to another. We haven't found a location where we can be permanent. So it's a little bit difficult because the high rents and the, it's quite tricky for us right now. But hopefully we're going to start moving from one place to another until we find the ideal location that we want.
Right, so you're not going to be permanently moving around like some of the other street traders. You're going to look for a permanent place.
Well, we are aiming to find permanent places, permanent pitches for us, because moving a bus is very tricky. It's not like a normal food truck, a small van that you can move around easily. So as you imagine, driving a double-decker bus is quite tricky.
Yeah, so, and parking it wouldn't be a joy
and parking,
either.
And especially with the small streets that Cambridge got, so it's quite tricky. So for us.
Tell me what sort of food you'll be serving.
We are going to serve South American street food using local ingredients from East Anglia and Cambridge.
Right, so what sort of street food is there in South America then?
Well, we have pretty much everything. In South America, you can't eat in the street every kind of food, but we're going to focus on empanadas, tostones, arepas, and eventually we're going to have our special prawns.
Oh, yes, because you did those earlier, didn't you, in December, those prawns, and they were very popular.
We did, yeah. They are very popular. They're yummy. They're super creamy. They're basically fried prawns. We put some special ingredients. I mean, it's our secret recipe, but they're very, very tasty. And people who try it, they always want more.
What about, will you be catering for all tastes? I mean, for example, will there be vegetarian? Will there be vegan?
Of course, our empanadas, the tostones and the arepas can be vegan and can be vegetarian as well. Basically, they fill up with everything. So we can fill it with meats for meat lovers, and we can fill it for vegetarians and for vegans as well. I have a very special vegan friend, and she tried one of the plantain empanadas, which is stuffed with mushrooms and plantain, and then is fried. And yeah, she really loved it.
Yeah, actually, yeah. There isn't a lot of plantain in Cambridge. That would be actually quite nice to vary our diet with.
Yeah, and plantain is so good. I mean, and you can have it salted and you can have the sweet one. So yeah. It's very, very nice. Mm. So plantain for the tostones is like the version of nachos, because basically you just fry them and then you can use dips, different kind of dips to eat it. And then you can put even meat as well in the plantain. So that's the tostones. It's basically fried plantain with dips.
Mm. And what about drinks?
Drinks. So we're going to bring the different kind of lemonade. So we got coconut lemonade, strawberry lemonade, and mint lemonade. And also we're going to have fresh fruit juices as well. At the moment, we can have alcohol because we haven't got alcohol license yet. But hopefully in the future, we can have some cocktails and some South American beers and wines too. But at the moment, we're not going to serve any alcohol drinks.
Mm. Right, but you're looking into that and...
We're looking for the future, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to find a permanent location in order to have the premises license to sell the alcohol. So until then, we can have the...
Yeah. Now, if there's anybody listening who has a space and they'd like to book you for it, how do they get in touch?
Of course, they can get in touch with us in our email. It's info@lalatinabastaurante.co.uk. And on our social media channels, we are on Instagram and lalatinabastaurante, and on Twitter, lalatinabas, and on our Facebook page, lalatinabastaurante too. So they can send us an email or they can call us on our profile. There is a number as well that they can call us. And of course, yeah, people can get in touch with us.
Yeah. And will you be doing, can you do private events like weddings, parties, that sort of thing? Are you available for that?
Yes. As far as the people have a big space for us in the parking or in the location, we can do any kind of events. Yeah.
Good. So you started work on the bus, I think it was last September, and I think you were pretty well forward with it even by Christmas. But it's now, well, it's now virtually May. It's taken quite a long time. What's the delay been?
One of the main reasons is because we are doing this while being a mom and dad full time for two kids under five, so they keep us very, very busy. So I'm doing all this job while being a full-time mom for these two. So being a full-time mom is already a tough job. So imagine putting all this on top. And also because they kind of the bus is taking different kind of permits or license, so we are not a normal food truck where people get the food and go away. People get to sit with us, and then so it's different kind of laws and regulations. But we already did all of the, and then
right. So it's been more complicated than the usual street trader would.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. But Channel 4 got onto you very early, didn't they? Because I know they filmed with you in December. I'm interested to know, this was for their programme Hidden Restaurants, wasn't it? I'm interested to know how they got to hear of you.
Well, that was very, like, a lucky moment for us, because last summer I was doing the market research for my business plan for this project. And then I was doing the research, and then I found out an advertisement of a lady doing asking for people who want to do this kind of business, and they're looking to do in the next 6 months. So she just sent me an email, and I sent that email with my idea and the things that we want to do. And then she just fell in love with that. And then she just called me next day. And then she said, well, the last word is the famous chef, Michel Rogue. He have to decide that. And then the next day she just called me, and then he fell in love with your idea. So you in? And I was like, what? Okay.
Better get ready then.
Exactly. So they were filming with us in September that we bought the bus. So they went with us back up to Liverpool when we bought the bus. And then they have been filming us, and then filming all the conversion process. And then on December, we did that gathering together to celebrate the end of the, well, not the end, but the end of the stage of the conversion, with the kitchen and the upstairs table and seats. And then, yeah, they were filming in, and then we were on the first episode of the program. It was very nice for us. We have very, very good comments, and then, well, create lots of expectations.
Yes, I think there's a lot of expectation, a lot of excitement. I think people would be very relieved that it's actually about to happen. Thanks
I'm
very
so
much,
pleased.
Catalina. Thank you very much
Alan,
for coming
thank
in.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, well, roll on the second week of May when they should start trading. Now, I can't go to their private launch tonight, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to be patient. By the way, they'll be getting their coffee from Sue Cam Coffee, which is in the market on Sundays, Thursdays, and we're here Fridays now too. And Sue is spelt X-U-E, so it's X-U-E Cam Coffee, and it's very good.
If you follow local football, then why not join From the Terraces Sunday at 6 o'clock each week and listen to Tim, Matt, Chris, Steve and Joe as we follow Cambridge United, Cambridge City, Histon and St Neots through another exciting season. From the Terraces will follow the season's highs and lows, providing comments, previews, reviews and interviews with players and manager. From the Terraces Sunday, 6 o'clock on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city.
A couple of years ago, Matt visited a farm that produces and sells its own honey, and he wanted to see what goes on in a hive and discovered that not only are there queens and drones, but also guard bees, sizable squadrons who keep a keen eye out for hapless feature makers. And so the following was recorded with the aid of a full beekeeper's uniform and thick, heavy gloves, so we apologise for any poor audio.
Bees have been getting increased exposure in the media recently. Lots of sudden realisation stories about our food chain being dependent upon them for pollinating millions of acres of agricultural crops. And then there's global warming, the impact of predatory species and diseases, European hornet invasions swiftly wiping out our polite, reserved, suit-and-tie-wearing British bumblebee. There's interesting news too. More and more people taking up beekeeping in urban areas, producing unusual honeys, as the bees source their pollen from people's garden plants and windowsill plant pots. And I'm here today on the outskirts of Cambridge, and I'm with Sarah Chandler and her partner Ian. So these beehives are called apiaries, is that right? It's a great term?
Apiaries.
An aviary.
Yeah, it's the whole place, if you know what I mean, is the apiary.
You're...
It's a place to keep bees.
Yes, yeah.
Right, next, A. A, B.
Well, it's a buzzing thing, isn't it?
How long have you been doing this now?
We've been doing it about 8 years. Found a swarm of bees on a walk once and kind of thought, hang on a minute, we should be doing this, you know.
Yeah,
we did a course at the Cambridge Beekeepers. They run every year.
All right, yes.
Plus, if you become a member, you can borrow equipment, so you don't have to buy an expensive extractor. You can just go and borrow them, which is nice. I've got 32 hives here in total, 10 big colonies, working hives, and the rest are all nukes, which are swarms I've collected. Mm. And when they fill out the frames, I'll transport them into a proper hive. So they don't like too much space, so you have to keep them small at first, you know, yes, so they can build out.
Swarms that you've collected sounds very interesting. It makes you sound like you're a hunter going off into the fields and you can identify where these places are. Is that roughly it?
What happens is I get a phone call because I'm on the website, the Bees Association, so people will have them in their garden, phone me up and I'll go and bring them back here.
But I have seen her follow them down the road in my car.
I have followed her, yes.
As it's gone over the top. Sometimes they don't stop.
They don't stop and
then
take off.
Can I have your keys? And off she went.
I did. I followed them. I followed them down and they landed in a tree and I caught them and brought them back.
Oh, wow.
Not escaping.
So you said these were some of these smaller hives?
Yeah, swarms that I've collected out of the tree. Got about 20,000 bees in. So what I've done is I've smoked them, and I've taken the roof off, and then we'll come down to a crown board, and then under the crown board is...
The honeycombs.
Yeah, this is where the bees make their honey.
Now, as you explained to me earlier, smoking prompts them to...
Prompts them to go and feed from the honey, so it fills their abdomen up to stop them stinging you. It doesn't actually make them sleepy. And as you can see, the hive, they like to stick everything up, so you need to get your hive tool under there and then unstick it. We take the super off, which is where the honey's stored. Then we come to a queen guard to stop the queen coming up into your honey. You don't want her laying eggs in your honey.
A queen guard.
Yeah.
Blimey, look at this. So you can identify just by looking externally here where the queen roughly is.
Yeah, she generally is where the eggs are laying.
So you can see them all feeding on the honey now. Now I'm smoking them.
Yes, yes.
They think there's a forest fire or something. They're all getting ready to leave, so they're gorging on the honey.
I noticed there that one of the combs you pulled out looked very fresh. So this is a fresh set of combs?
This is a fresh hive, yeah. This is all the wax sheets here, and then they draw the wax out.
How long has it taken them to produce this?
These have been in here a week, so they're on 5 frames now. See, there's some little larvae in there.
Oh, yes, yes.
They're the babies.
Oh, and I can see some dark coloured
pollen. Yeah. The sort of green stuff's the hawthorn.
Yes.
And it just varies on what they're feeding.
Now, look at this.
No, she's not. Oh, no, she's there. Look.
There you go.
She's bigger, but she's not as big as I thought she would be. But you homed in on her straight away.
She's got a longer body. That was probably luck more than anything. She's just got a longer abdomen, so she can reach down into the cells and lay her egg. That's why the workers can't do it.
Ah, right.
So it's only her.
You bugger.
It's got you. Should we move?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've set them off now.
And when you're checking them, what is it that you're checking for?
I'm checking to make sure the queen's still in there.
Yeah.
So, because we don't want to lose the queen and have no eggs, otherwise that's your hive gone. And I'm checking for diseases and pests. So,
okay.
Like
Varroa mites. Wax moths.
And wax moths.
Are things like varroa mites easy to spot as well?
Varroa mites are very tiny. They're almost like fleas.
Mm.
They're really small, but you can tell because some of the bees will have like chewed off wings.
I think I saw some photos where it looks like they almost piggyback off the back of the bumblebee, but they look like a backpack.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we use varroa mite treatment over winter being
they
infested.
Do use sulfur dioxide, is it now?
Yes.
But which we don't use that. They really don't like that.
No.
But people are using it now.
So that's a stronger, harsher chemical, is it?
I think so.
Yeah. More like acid, I think.
Yeah.
It's not very nice. We use icing sugar to control the varroa mite, which is a more natural way of doing it.
Oh.
So you sprinkle the icing sugar on the top of the hive when you've finished, and that will sort the varroa mite out.
Is there a reason why more beekeepers don't do that? Is it just because you need more of that to produce the same effect as the chemical?
I think it's people don't know, really. I think it is just something that, you know, people pick up, and it is becoming more popular to use ice and sugar rather than chemicals.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Okay, so here's the next one. Because every one of your beehives here are raised off the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's for ease of work, I think.
Yeah,
more than
my back.
Ah, now look at this.
I've been taking honey
off
these, so there's not
as
much
there. Wow, these guys are automatically much more aggressive, I think.
Yeah, there's just more.
There's more in here, so yeah, and I've been taking the honey, so they're not that happy at the moment.
Ah. And perhaps, a very neophyte question, but how do you take their honey from them?
I lift the supers off and scrape all the bees off. Well, not scrape them off, but you brush them off.
Yeah.
Gently. And then I take it to a centrifuge and spin it. You're standing in there.
Just lifting off the...
Standing in their flight path.
Oh, am I?
Yeah.
Ah, that's why. Should I stand to the side?
See
how they've stuck it all together
with
the propolis?
Stuck it down.
What was that word you used just then?
Propolis.
Propolis.
Yeah, which is their glue.
Ah.
Which is all this dark orange...
Yes, yes.
And that's sticky.
That is very sticky. Yeah, it's very sticky.
Very stuck.
Very stuck.
Oh, wow.
Sorry. I'm gonna roll the bees. I don't particularly like that.
Look at that. Whoa, I'm being attacked everywhere. Okay, this is a test of your mettle. Blimey.
It's scary, isn't it?
It is scary, yeah. Whew. Now, this honeycomb is so much darker. It's more like a coffee colour.
Yeah, this is an older one, so it's been in there a year or two. So the longer it's in there, the darker it gets because they start building it up with propolis.
Yes.
It makes it harder to work with as well when they start getting a bit, darker because you can't see the eggs.
Yeah, normally on a hot day, that's when you choose to come in.
Half of these will be out. That's why you don't want to come in.
Oh, I see. So actually, coming here on a cooler day, just after it's been raining, is worse for recording.
Yes.
This is quite intense.
Yeah.
Very. They hate this microphone. They hate my hair.
Right, it's only a sting.
But myself and Ian are all tightly suited up here. I feel like there's nowhere that the bees could get through, but you know from experience that the bees will find...
There's a space.
Yeah, I had one in the veil.
I didn't tell you before you went in. But last time I wore that suit, one got in.
Yeah?
Yeah, and then I'll walk up, find the little nook and cranny.
Yeah.
And it was just there at the front, and I managed to... before it got me, but...
I mean, something that starts with A, B.
Honey? Honey starts with a bee.
He's right, you know, Blackadder. Honey does start with a bee. And a flower, too.
Now, honey is sometimes referred to as nature's benign golden sweetener. It never goes bad. It's baked into everything from cereals to biscuits, sauces and medicines, and it will crystallise over time. The more pollen in your honey, the quicker it crystallises.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he went for it.
I got stung on the eye once. That was...
You got stung on the eye?
Right on the corner of the eye.
Oh.
Sarah had been in the hive around, and I was nowhere near, and it just went bash.
Yeah.
And it got me, and that made me swell up. I looked pretty good for about a week.
Were you just risking it? As in, were
no,
you going
no,
out?
No,
he wasn't even in near the bees.
It. She'd finished.
I was in the bees, and I'd come around a corner, and he was miles away.
And I didn't even see it coming, and it just. But it's just the way it swelled up. It went down my face, and I looked good. I looked like I'd been in a fight. I did.
You had been in a fight.
Well, yeah, I lost as well.
The ivy extraction, that's the stuff that you leave for the bees in order to survive the winter.
Yeah. We like to give them a bit of honey back, not just give them loads of sugar. So
you can buy feed from other places, but we kind of want to keep it as pure and natural to them.
Mm.
We tend to just let them have their own feed, which is easier for us and nicer for them.
So with these 30 hives that you have here, Sarah, you produce the honey?
Yes, we produce the honey and we jar it up and we sell it out the front of our holding. We're in Haslingfield, up Cantilope Road, and yeah, we have two different types of honey at the moment. We have the creamed honey and we have the runny honey. Creamed honey creams because of the rape seed that we have around here. So it goes hard and then we basically heat it up to 40 degrees and then we get like a potato masher and you mash it. And once it's creamed, it's not hard, it's spreadable honey rather than being granulated.
And how long does it take for you to produce it? There must be a lot of work involved.
You have to extract it, so you put the frames into an extractor and then, I mean, that take a good hour to just extract.
You mentioned a centrifuge earlier.
Yeah, that's the honey extractor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you put the frames in and you just spin a handle and it spins off into a jug and then you have to put it into a settling container after that to get all the bubbles out, and before you put it in there you have to send it through some sieves to, you know, to get out the, you know, bits of wax and propolis and the odd bee that ends up in it. So you leave it in the storage containers and then after about a week you can then jar it up and then label it up and sell it.
So Sarah Chandler and Ian, very nice to meet you. It's nice to meet your bees as well.
Yes.
They were very happy to chat.
Sorry.
And we're here at Haslingfield in the farm in Haslingfield.
Yes.
Just up Cantilope Road.
Hawthorn Farm, for all those people who want to come and purchase your honey.
Yeah. Yep.
Runny and creamy.
Yep.
Well, Sarah and Ian, thank you very much. And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was Hawthorn Farm in Haslingfield. You know, it really gets a bit scary when you you honestly can't tell if the bees have finally managed to get inside your veil. Anyway, as the label on the jar says, this is pure Cambridge honey, and they sell the creamed and the runny in one-pound jars. That's roughly 450 grams.
Yeah, it sounds terrifying, Matt. Anyway, if you're interested in keeping bees yourself, Sarah and Ian mentioned the Cambridgeshire Beekeepers Association, who run a course for beginners consisting of 8 evening classes that take place at Chesterton Community College on Gilbert Road, and the course is around £45. You can find out all about it by visiting their website, cbka.org.uk.
And Hawthorn Farm, this is a family-run small holding. It's also online at hawthornfarm.net. You can buy the honey direct from them, as well as other farm produce. Well, you could hear all those animals in the background. They do lamb, pork and free-range eggs. But by the way, this isn't the same Hawthorn Farm that's on the market square. This is a different one. And also, let's talk a little bit now about neonicotinoids, because they've been in the news recently. The EU wants to place a ban on all neonicotinoid seed treatments from being extended across all crops in the UK. Currently, the ban is just on oilseed rape production.
Yes, but farmers contend this will decimate UK crop production, pushing up consumer prices or forcing us to buy in extra crops from countries who sell them cheaper and are allowed to use the pesticide.
Now, these neonicotinoids, they're a chemical. They kill viruses, they kill plant pests like beetles and weevils, but it's also alleged that they kill pollinators such as the bee. And the plants themselves, as a result of being coated in this pesticide, they produce a toxic liquid, which also the bee drinks from and dies from.
Mad bee disease, first reported nearly two decades ago. And as a result, the French banned neonicotinoids. And then there was a colony collapse disorder in 27 United States. And 3 years ago, the EU imposed a moratorium on three types of neonicotinoids. The UK Food and Environmental Research Agency, on the other hand, found no evidence of harm for bees.
So this counter-argument claims that the major threats to the bees are actually from conventional agriculture that's becoming more intensive, and also the effects of climate change. So, in 3 weeks' time, the issue will be discussed at the European Commission, and then we will know whether the UK will face a countrywide ban on neonicotinoid use. And on to the food and drink news. It's, of course, a bank holiday weekend, so some nice food events coming up. And first, some jobs.
Yes, Prana, the Indian restaurant in Mill Road, is looking for waiting staff evenings only. Pop in with your CV.
The Green Man in Grantchester is after permanent full-time waiting and bar staff, so address your CV to Steve Thompson, who you heard earlier, and take it into the pub.
The Kingston Arms in Kingston Street wants a head chef. Send your CV to director.kingston.arms@ntlworld.com.
Today, tomorrow and Fridays too. Until the end of September, in fact, there's the Thirsty Beer Garden. There'll be food trucks, including Provenance Kitchen with a Sunday brunch, Jack's Gelato, lots of others. There'll be craft beer, wines, spirits and soft drinks too. There'll be tables and seating for 200 under large umbrellas. Really is marvellous, this. It's on the riverside by the Museum of Technology.
Tonight at Hot Numbers in Gwydir Street, there's a barista jam. And here's Jack Kiff from Hot Numbers with more.
So it sounds like pretty weird, but basically we've got kind of coffee competitions going on. So there's going to be people brewing different coffees, doing like latte art, stuff like that, and also a cupping one as well, which anyone is welcome to sign up for. We've got like five different coffees. You've got to taste them, try and memorise the order, and then we'll mess them up and you've got to try and put them back kind of thing. So it's pretty hard. But so please, if you're interested, have a look for competing. If not, please just come along. It would be wicked to just get loads of people involved. Just come and see what's going on, see what coffee people get up to. There's wicked prizes coming. We've got some good stuff coming. Free to enter as well, and whether you're competing or just coming along. We'll have loads of beer. It's going to be here at Gwydir. Getting people down at like kind of 6:45, going on to about 10. Please come along, because it'll be great to see loads of familiar faces, and tell your friends and everything as well.
Yeah, it's free. If you want to take part, you'll need to register at Eventbrite, where the event is called Cambridge Barista Jam.
At Calverley's Brewery today, Joey Jojo Herbo is serving tacos from now till 3 p.m. and then later in the day from 6 till 9 p.m. You might remember Joe, he was in our 21st of January episode this year, which you can find on our podcasts.
Yeah, and we mentioned Food Park in Grant Place and Kura Kura being there. In addition, there's Gorilla Kitchen and Shoe Stoppers.
And tomorrow, the Garden Kitchen takes over at Co-15 in Cherry Hinton. They're doing Sunday brunch with items like porridge with fresh fruit and honey, pancakes with bacon and maple syrup, and that's from 9:30 to 2 p.m. And from 12 to 3:30, there's lunch, which includes roast lamb with rosemary potatoes, roast veg and rocket pesto. And for vegetarians, there's stuffed mushrooms with cauliflower nut roast.
In our last programme, we featured Neera from the Derby Stores in Derby Street. And Neera is producing homemade Punjabi curries. And there are fresh ones every day, but she's now started doing occasional specials too. And yesterday, it was goat curry, and this coming Wednesday, it's mutton curry.
The first of the Food Park Night Markets is on the 27th of May from 5 till 10 p.m. at Gravel Hill Farm. That's just off Maddingley Road. Tickets are £4 for adults, free for children. Advanced booking is recommended. That's from Eventbrite. So look up Food Park Night Market. Well, not surprising, really. And finally, looking ahead, Bill Sewell, who we heard earlier, is speaking about his journey from concerned London vegetarian to enthusiastic rural omnivore at the Hay Festival in Hay-on-Wye. He's on at 7 p.m. from the 31st of May, and it costs £7.30.
And that's all we have time for today. The podcast will be available early next week.
Yeah, remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter at flavour105. And you can follow Cambridge 105 Radio at Cambridge 105.
But that's all from us for today. We'll be back on the 12th of May. But until then, goodbye.
Bye.